from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. Stock markets take a dive, at once reflecting and stirring fears of a global recession. President Trump had been boasting about the economy. Now he's trying to make a hard pivot. Last night, he told New Hampshire voters the bad news meant they have to give him a second turn in office.
You have no choice but to vote for me because your 401ks, down the tubes, everything's going to be down the tubes. So whether you love me or hate me, you got to vote for me.
An unprecedented rebuke of American lawmakers. Israel blocks entry to Democratic Representatives Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib after urging from President Trump. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu cited the two lawmakers' support for boycotts of Israel. Tlaib spoke yesterday to TV station WXYZ in Detroit.
You know, my grandmother's in her 90s. Her granddaughter is a United States Congresswoman. She should have to be able to see me, to touch me, to hug me. And so I'm going to continue to fight back.
Legal battles, investigations, and conspiracy theories surge after the death of financier Jeffrey Epstein in federal jail, apparently a suicide. Jennifer Arose is suing the Epstein estate, claiming he raped her. Her attorney Kimberly Turner spoke to NBC News on Wednesday.
Jennifer was a 14-year-old child. He was a predator. He groomed her. He had help. And everybody who helped him should be held responsible for ruining Jennifer's life.
Join us. What's your reaction to Israel's decision to block the two Democratic representatives? What's your thoughts on how the representatives have handled that? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from Washington, D.C., Ginger Gibson. She's political correspondent for Reuters. Ginger, great to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Washington is Tolu Olorunipa. He's White House reporter for The Washington Post. Tolu, great to have you with us as well.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And of course, from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point's own news analyst Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, David, Ginger, and Tolu.
So let's start with the news at the top of the hour. Here we go. On his way to a rally in New Hampshire yesterday, President Trump told reporters he can't imagine why Israel would allow entry to Representatives Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, both Democrats he has attacked in the past.
They are very anti-Jewish and they're very anti-Israel. I think it's disgraceful, the things they've said. You have lists of, this isn't just a one-line mistake. What they've said about Israel and Jewish people is a horrible thing, and they've become the face of the Democrat Party. So I did absolutely put out a very strong statement.
Now, a lot's happened in the ensuing hours. The Israeli authorities said, Ginger Gibson, that they were going to allow Congresswoman Tlaib to visit her grandmother, the occupied West Bank. And yet she announced this morning wasn't acceptable. She said, and this is an excerpt of her statement, in my attempt to visit Palestine, I've experienced the same racist treatment that many Palestinian Americans endure when encountering the Israeli government. She goes on to say, visiting my grandmother under these oppressive conditions meant to humiliate me would break my grandmother's heart. She had been asked to promise not to protest or object to Israeli policy when she was in going through Israel. She says, silencing me with treatment to make me feel less than is not what she wants for me. It would kill a piece of me that always stands up against racism and injustice. Ginger Gibson, gives us a feel of what just played out in the last 24 hours or so.
We're watching a domestic and international episode play out in which the lines are not falling in a way that you would have traditionally expected. We would have thought that the United States president would have been backing members of Congress, maybe even ones he disagrees with. But what we see is a president who likes having this fight with these members of Congress. He clearly sees it as politically advantageous to himself. And he's happy to interject himself into this fight. There was no reason on Thursday that he needed to come out and start advocating that a foreign country block members of Congress. He voluntarily hopped into this fight on Twitter. And then when asked by reporters later, really, we're seeing something that Trump thinks plays well with his base if he's disparaging these members of Congress. And then we saw after Israel made the decision to bar them from entering the country, new sort sort of lines pop up. We have members of Congress, someone like Marco Rubio, who has been quite a staunch defender and supporter, an ally of Israel, criticize that decision. So really was an incident or an incident that continues to play out that has divided people in a way you wouldn't expect and has really become something that it looks like President Trump feels is a political win for him.
Tolu, let's talk about that a little bit. And let's start with that question. Why would this be a political win for President Trump? Why would it be a win for him to say, I believe his tweet said something like, Israel will look weak if it admits these two lawmakers into the country. Why is that a good thing for him?
Well, first, just to take a step back, typically politics stops at the water's edge, so you wouldn't expect a president to be playing politics against his domestic political rivals by using international diplomacy and sort of siding with a foreign government against members of his own Congress. But the fact that we are very far past that norm means the president is willing to play politics with these types of international conflagrations. And the reason he thinks it's good for his political base is because, as he said in his own words, he wants these Democratic lawmakers, specifically the squad for minority law congresswomen, to be the face of the Democratic Party. He thinks that they are far left on not only their positions on Israel, but on domestic policies and social policies. And he wants them to represent the Democratic Party. The fact that the Democrats are having some internal struggles over their own positions and their positions on immigration and other issues means that the president feels like he can win by inflaming some of those internal tensions on the Democratic side and causing all of the Democrats to defend what he believes are the most extreme versions of Democratic mainstream policies. So he thinks it's a winner because he's able to get the Democrats to defend these people who aren't necessarily completely popular within the party because they have taken such a bold approach to so many different issues. But it does really inflame what typically presidents have stayed away from, which is siding with a foreign government against members of their own U.S. lawmaking apparatus.
I want to take a quick call from Detroit, Michigan. That's the hometown of Congresswoman Tlaib. Tom is calling in. What are your thoughts, Tom?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I say to Congresswoman Tlaib, she should go there without any restrictions on her or don't go at all. And I mean, the bottom line is, you know, who is Trump to sit there and tell another government not to let elected lawmakers in, okay? You know, it would be the same thing as if, you know, Trump wanted to go over there to Palestine, all right? And Tlaib and Omar would say, well, no, don't let him come over there because of his, you know, this misogynism and the whole nine yards that he's done ever since he's been in office.
Well, thank you for that, Tom. I guess Tom is, you know, has his elected officials, both the congresswoman and the president. They are at odds in a way that, as Tolu points out, is not usual. Jack Beatty, I want to turn for a moment. We've experienced this thing with the economy. There's been a lot. We mentioned the markets at the top. People pay attention to the stock market. The president alludes to it. And yet, you know, there's the question of these inverted bonds and the inverted yields happening. And forgive me, but I want to play a clip here. It's the yield of a 10-year Treasury bond dips below that of a 2-year bond on Wednesday. That is what I'm talking about here, the inverted yield curve. That's usually seen as a predictor of a coming recession. Here's White House trade advisor Peter Navarro. He placed blame on the Federal Reserve for that dire omen in an interview with Fox News' Sandra Smith later that day.
They are causing this because when Jay Powell got in as chairman, he proceeded to raise interest rates by 100 basis points. The problem when you have an inverted yield curve is it's viewed as a sign of a slowdown. But here's the thing.
It's viewed as a sign of a recession. Hold on. But Peter, it's not just viewed as a sign of a slowdown. It's historically been accurate in predicting recessions. That yield curve is inverted for the first time since 2007.
So, Jack Beatty, the president is now saying this is all a good reason to stick with him, even as he's previously been saying, you know, I've been juicing the economy for you folks. You better stay with me. What is the president's appeal? How is he going to make that pitch successfully?
Well, he's going to find it very difficult if the economy slows down. And to judge by the latest forecast from Goldman Sachs, it's apt to slow down in the fourth quarter beneath 2%. The president had been talking about 3 or 4%. So if the economy continues to slow, if, as the Washington Post reported this week, more and more industries, notably transportation, entertainment, services, information services, cut back on their hiring, we may be facing a slowing and perhaps even a recessionary economy. Already people are talking about an earnings recession. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the president brings up this big flap with these congresswomen going to Israel. He has a genius for deflection. And this, of course, deflects from the pecuniary swoon on Wall Street and the general sense that the president has not alone, but that his policies have contributed mightily to a sense of uncertainty. Everything you read that business people say, we had some business executives on this week on our program who were saying, we don't know what to do. The man has a whim of iron. One day he'll say this about trade. The next day he'll say that. We don't know when to order, what to order, whom to hire. This kind of uncertainty, quite apart from the economic damage that, extracted from the economy in these tariffs, the tax on American consumers and companies, the hurt of American farmers and exporters, quite apart from that, just the uncertainty has begun to affect the animal spirits that keep an economy up.
I see the Washington Post reporting this morning that Germany, the UK, Italy, Mexico, Brazil, Argentina, Singapore, South Korea, and Russia are all on the verge of the recession, driving fears of the U.S. I also see reports that the president himself, Tolu, is not accepting of a lot of the data that his own government is coming up with now that they're turning the wrong way. Briefly, how much is that a serious thing and how much is that a political thing by the president?
Well, I would say that the president is very much focused on the politics of this. He has gotten some language from people close to him who say, you need to be concerned about this. But he has said, according to our reporting, that he does not believe the numbers. And that is a scary thing, the fact that the president doesn't believe numbers coming from his own government.
We're talking about the biggest news of the week in Washington and beyond. Join our conversation. What do you make of the Trump administration's new position that would deny green cards to immigrants who use public benefits? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're taking a look at the week's top news stories. You can join our conversation. What questions do you have about Chinese efforts to smother unrest in Hong Kong and the U.S. response? Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking today with Ginger Gibson. She's political correspondent for Reuters. Tolu Olorunipa, he's White House reporter for The Washington Post, and On Point's own news analyst, Jack Beatty. Let's turn now to immigration, sort of one of these viral moments that also reveals some significant policy implications. On Tuesday, in a memorable moment on NPR's Morning Edition, acting director of the Citizenship and Immigration Services Office, Ken Cuccinelli, sought to promote the new Trump administration policy denying green cards to immigrants who accept public benefits. NPR's Rachel Martin pressed him on that.
Would you also agree that Emma Lazarus's words etched on the Statue of Liberty, give me your tired, your poor, are also part of the American ethos?
They certainly are. Give me your tired and your poor who can stand on their own two feet and who will not become a public charge. That plaque was put on the Statue of Liberty at almost the same time as the first public charge law was passed. Very interesting timing.
Now, give me your tired, your poor who can stand on your own two feet created a lot of controversy on Tuesday. Cuccinelli made the rounds on CNN. Here's how he tried to explain himself to CNN's Aaron Burnett later that day.
Well, of course, that poem was referring back to people coming from Europe where they had class-based societies where people were considered wretched if they weren't in the right class. And it was written 1 year 1 year after the first federal public charge rule was written that says, and I'll quote it, any person unable to take care of himself without becoming a public charge, unquote, would be inadmissible.
So the Public Charge Act Cuccinelli is referring to was included in the Immigration Act of 1882, the year before Lazarus wrote her sonnet. Our producers in researching this say the U.S. government did not require that all non-U.S. citizens register with the federal government and therefore obtain alien registration receipt cards, the predecessor to green cards, until the year 1940. Jack Beatty, what do you make of what Cuccinelli said, both in terms of policy and in terms of his rhetoric?
Well, it's a cruel policy. It essentially will take families who are working. Most non-citizens are working, and the Bureau of Labor Statistics confirms that they're working for markedly less than native-born earners. For example, a fifth less. So occasionally they have to resort to food stamps, to Medicaid in order to make ends meet or to get medical care. And the great fear here is that people who are eligible for those things will not apply out of fear of being losing their quest for citizenship. So it could even be a counterproductive. Well, in terms of children missing health checkups and so on, it could be quite painful indeed. And this is at a moment when, as the New York Times reports, the Labor Department says 7 million jobs are going unfulfilled, even as the economy, quote unquote, for now, appears to be booming or at least moving. And then the kinds of jobs that are needed to be done are the ones that immigrants typically have done, the ones at the bottom, the ones that leave them open to exploitation, as we saw in the Mississippi poultry houses last mm-hmm. week.
Tolu, assuming the authorities aren't coming for reporters for the Washington Post at the moment back there, I wanted to ask you a little bit about the rhetoric that when Cuccinelli says this is really talking about people from Europe and class, was he making a historic point or was he indicating that, you know, people that we want to be in this country, as the president has seemed to suggest in seemingly favoring Scandinavian immigrants, really we should be looking eastward across the Atlantic? That's where we think of immigrants truly coming from.
Yes, and sorry about our fire alarm system here.
Quite
yes, right. It does sound like Ken Cuccinelli is making that broader point that the Trump administration has been pushing forward, that we want immigrants from certain countries, but we don't want immigrants from countries where, you know, there's poverty or where, you know, the culture may be different from what President Trump views as traditional American culture. You have to remember that the president put forward a Muslim ban when he was campaigning for president, saying that he didn't want any people coming from Muslim countries. And as he has pushed forward his immigration policy, it has been skewed towards saying, you know, we want people with high skilled backgrounds, people from countries like Norway in the president's view, and we don't want as many people from countries that he views as poor or impoverished or not in line with American culture. It is a revisionist version of American history. This country has always taken in people who have not necessarily had a lot of money, not the aristocrats of the old ages, but people who, you know, wanted to pursue the American dream. And there is a long history of people coming here with nothing and building the American dream for their family and building a career for their next generation. And it seems like this administration is trying to rewrite much of that history and say that that is not the country we want to be anymore.
Would like to quickly take a call now from Hampton Bays, New York. Rose, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling in.
Sure. How are you?
Doing great. What's on your mind?
I just want to say that I recently legally immigrated my husband to the country from a country that might have originally been on a ban list. And I do have to say that all of these rules and things that people are saying that President Trump is trying to do are already in effect. Most people have no idea what's involved in legally immigrating to this country. Basically, you have to sponsor a person. You have to show a certain level of income yourself. And on all of the paperwork, you have to agree that the person you are bringing into the country is not going to be going on public assistance. If I did not have enough money to immigrate my husband here, he would have been denied entry. And we started the process while the last election was rolling. And I was definitely afraid that my husband was not going to be able to make it here, but he certainly did. And we followed the rules, filled out the forms, paid all the fees, agreed to what was being asked of us, and have no intentions on going on public assistance.
All right. So let me, Rose, very quickly ask you two quick factual questions. And first is, can you tell us what country your husband immigrated from?
From Egypt.
And the second question I'd ask is, do you consider yourself now, given that you followed the rules and that you feel that this is consistent, do you support the president?
I don't want to say whether I'm supportive or not supportive of this administration. There's a lot of crazy stuff going on.
Okay, thank you for that, Rose. I just want to throw this to Ginger Gibson, because I think an interesting point is raised. You know, Ken Cuccinelli used language and seemingly diverted Emma Lazarus's language. He said, look, this is consistent with what we've done for decades in this country, for a long time for this country. In some ways, Lazarus's words were aspirational for this country, even rather than pure policy, right? But there is a point to what Rose is saying. People have been asked, I think my great-grandfather once, in getting a passport, had to attest that he wasn't going to bring people here from the old country, you know, to come back here. Now it's a question of not bringing people here who might need public support. What is the concern about that? Why is Ken Cuccinelli's words in a policy way also stirring criticism?
I think that people in the United States understand that we basically have two immigration systems. We have one where you come through the front door and one where you come through the back door. And when we talk about immigration, we try to conflate the two. And I think we, critics of immigration at least, try to make it seem like everyone coming through either door oftentimes are trying to just get one over, are trying to scam something, to get something free, and that they're trying to exploit the system. They're, you know, to get on welfare, to get health insurance, to get things, to take things away from people who are already in the country. And supporters say, look, like, we can look at all the numbers, and I think Frank really laid those out really well, that when immigrants come here, they actually don't take much public assistance. They actually do really tough jobs, and they work overwhelmingly more even than some of the already here American population. But I think the criticism as of Cuccinelli and of the president's use of the immigration laws is where we see it. And we see it in the Democratic debate when they talk about repealing or changing the laws. And they say, well, but these laws have been on the books for 80, 60, 70, 90 years. They've been here for a long time. We're just following the laws. But they haven't been enforced that way in a long time. And so Cuccinelli may be right. They're just following the laws on the book. But at this point, given how the president has enforced existing laws that didn't result in, you know, child migrant camps on the border until now, there's a lot of apprehension that even him enforcing the laws or what he views as an enforcement of the laws will go too far. In a democracy, in a legislative system like we have, there's always that tension that one group writes laws and the other has to execute them. It feels, I think, right now among critics of the way that the immigration system looks at this moment is that these laws are being executed in a way that they weren't intended. And I think that that's a bit of what we're seeing here and why saying something like that just evokes such a strong reaction from critics of Cuccinelli and the president that this was an attempt to stamp out all poor people trying to come here and to paint all people who try to come to the United States as just wanting to build the system.
Ginger Gibson, I want to turn now to another story that has gone from the scandal pages to the front pages of the nation's leading newspapers and taken up by major administration officials. Let's turn now to the question of the disgraced financier Jeffrey Epstein. Epstein died by apparent suicide last weekend in custody in a federal jail. Michelle Licata accuses Epstein of sexually abusing her when she was a teenager. She spoke to CBS News on Wednesday.
I never wanted him to die. I just wanted him to sit there, like I had to sit there after it happened, and thinking like, oh my gosh, no one's ever gonna love me. I can't ever be with anybody. A good I'm sorry would just have been good enough. I didn't deserve to like not be a teenage girl anymore.
Ginger Gibson, you've seen the President of the United States raise questions whether there's conspiracies involved, perhaps implicating, without any evidence whatsoever, the Clinton family in Epstein's death. Attorney General Bill Barr has said, you know, it seems to him outrageous that somebody who had attempted to commit suicide earlier could die apparently by suicide in federal custody. Where do things stand in terms of the Justice Department, all this?
I think one thing we have to think about is a reminder that our federal prison system is not designed to keep people alive. And I think we're seeing this play out on a really broad scale, and one in which everyone's paying attention to. But that aside, Jeffrey Epstein's death will probably be the death that spurs a million conspiracy theories, and on both sides. There was a Washington Post report later in the week that there were multiple breaks in his neck. That prompted more conspiracy theories, even though you break the bones in your neck when you hang yourself. So it could have been very consistent with a suicide. I have to say, especially with the president tweeting conspiracy theories, the internet filling up with conspiracy theories on both sides of the political aisle, I would be shocked if we ever put any of these to bed. I feel like reporters will be getting emails about Jeffrey Epstein conspiracy theories for decades to come. They will never all be put to rest.
Tolu, you know, Jeffrey Epstein in earlier incarnations palled around with now President Trump. At various points, he also flew President Clinton to various places, I believe, including Africa. No one has alleged wrongdoing by either of them in connection to the growing, accusations against Epstein per se. Why is the president weighing in? How do his aides feel about the fact he's weighing in, goading conspiracies against his former social friends and now political rivals, the Clintons?
Well, I think the aides that are still around the president have gotten used to this type of behavior, so they're somewhat numb to the fact that he's going to do things that are very far out of the box and the minds of many out of line. There is a connection with the president in addition to his longstanding relationship in the past with Jeffrey Epstein. The president appointed a labor secretary, Alex Acosta, who basically was the person when he was a U.S. attorney down in South Florida who orchestrated the plea deal that Jeffrey Epstein got that many people have looked at in retrospect and seen it as very light. He only got about 13 months in jail for what many people believed was a sex trafficking operation that targeted minor girls. And the fact that the president stood by Mr. Acosta for so many months after this reporting came out before finally letting him resign, that's one of the reasons the president is connected to this case and one of the reasons he feels the need to involve himself in sort of clearing up the record or creating a distraction or pointing the finger at the Clintons, because there are a lot of questions about his own role in how he handled his own labor secretary, who had a direct role and influence in the genesis of this case and closing it in a way that many people believed did not deliver justice to the victims.
And Jack Beatty, I want to turn briefly before the end of this segment to across the Pacific to Hong Kong. Protests shut down the airport there repeatedly this week. Here's part of a report Monday from the Singapore-based news service CAN.
This is by far the biggest turnout in a peaceful sit-in at the airport. This after one of the female protesters had allegedly ruptured her right eye after being shot with a beanbag round during violent clashes at Tsim Sha Tsui overnight. These protesters' slogans here is today, police return an eye for an eye, they say.
Jack Beatty, China obviously has had possession of Hong Kong since the turnover from the British over two decades ago, and yet there's been these different political traditions there that they promised to have some respect for, a fair amount of repression, it seems, in the face of dissent. What do you see happening there, and what do you feel about the American response to it?
Well, you know, I remember some years ago being at a dinner party where there was a man from Argentina, and he looked across the table and he said, "I am alive because of Jimmy Carter." What he meant was he had been a political prisoner in Argentina, and the Carter human rights policy, notably Patricia Darien, the leader of that from the State Department, had pressured the Argentine government to let him and other political prisoners go. And Carter took a lead on human rights all over the globe. I must say I felt prouder of my government at that moment than I had in years. That is what the American foreign policy is supposed to be about.
And what have
human
we seen
rights,
here?
Democracy. Here we see the president calling the demonstrators, using the word riot, saying they're, which is just the word the Chinese use in their propaganda. And according to the Financial Times, telling Mr. President Xi, look, we'll go easy on Hong Kong, and telling his diplomats to go easy on Hong Kong to get some concession on trade. This isn't America.
We're discussing the week in the news. Coming up, we'll speak to Democratic Senator Michael Bennett of Colorado about his presidential bid. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're following other news this week. For instance, the Trump administration on Monday significantly weakened the enforcement of the Endangered Species Act, making it easier to remove species from those protections gained by being on that list. And nearly three dozen young people across the country were hospitalized for difficulty breathing after vaping. Doctors are still unsure about the underlying cause, but there is growing concern about the effects of vaping on young lungs. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking with Ginger Gibson. She's political correspondent for Reuters. Tolaru Olorunipa, he's White House reporter for The Washington Post, and our own news analyst here at On Point, Jack Beatty. Joining me now from Boston, Massachusetts, the Democratic U.S. Senator for Colorado and presidential candidate Michael Bennett. Senator Bennett, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, David. It's good to hear your voice.
Thank you, sir. So you've written a book previously, as many presidential candidates do, sort of laying out their philosophy, where they come from. You've also come up with a new book that you've published about Mitch McConnell. What are you doing there?
Well, it was a book. It's really a book about the Russian hacking of our election, because I thought that nobody in America really understood what the Russian propaganda looks like. And there's a reason for that, by the way. It's propaganda, and they didn't want to be discovered. So for a year, it was in the bloodstream of our political system, and nobody here knew, including our intelligence agencies, much less Facebook, knew that it was here. And as I've traveled the country, I've realized that people still don't know what it looks like. I had a guy in New Hampshire the other day say to me in a nursing home, just make sure Obama's not taking money from veterans and giving it to refugees. That comes straight out of the propaganda. So I've tried to put the book out there so people can see what it looks like, and they can go to RussiaHackedOurDemocracy.com, and anybody can look at it and or download it if they want. And if they want to, they can send a copy to Mitch McConnell and demand that the majority leader of the United States put the election protection legislation on the floor. He's blocked it eight times, and I think it's an outrage.
Mitch McConnell, obviously, a Republican senator from Kentucky, is the Senate Majority Leader. Speaking of the Senate, your fellow Coloradan, former Governor John Hickenlooper, announced he would step back from the presidential fray, and it sounds like he's going to enter the Senate. You had a conversation with him earlier this week. What did you it sounds as though he's going to end at the Senate race. What did you advise him, or what was the conversation about?
Yeah, I didn't really give him so much advice as just describe what it was like to be in the Senate and what the challenges are. Our exercise in self-government is under extraordinary strain. It was before Trump arrived. It's worse since he did arrive. And I think it's up to all of us, every single one of us, no matter what role we have to play, to try to salvage this democracy and restore it. And we talked a lot about that.
Mm-hmm. You've staked out a position. You've told people in recent weeks, possibly longer, that you say, listen, in some ways you're going to be able to live your lives if I'm elected president, right? Things are not going to be – there's not going to be so much hyperventilating. I'm going to actually run the government. We're going to have a lot of good things going on. You've also presented yourself as a voice, it seems to me, for moderation, a certain kinds of center-left centrism in the Democratic Party. What do you see as the appeal as you go out and talk to voters, the hunger for that as opposed to perhaps a more populist expression that you see from those who are supporting the likes of Senators Sanders and Warren?
Yeah. Well, I'd say, David, in the first point, that people are desperate to have a competent president again, and they would like to go on with their lives. This is not a reality TV show. Donald Trump thinks it is. It isn't. And for people like the kids I used to work for in the Denver Public Schools when I was their superintendent and for their parents, Donald Trump has literally done nothing since the day he crossed the threshold of the White House, and I don't anticipate he'll do anything useful for them in the next 2 years. And I think that's how most people feel about it. At least folks that think that we all have a responsibility and a job to do. And they also have jobs to do. That's the other thing. People have to live their lives. They've got to figure out how to pay for school. They've got to figure out how to build their small business. And every day to wake up with a guy in the White House who at least plays the part of a lunatic isn't helping America. I mean, today we woke up to the news that he's been talking about trying to buy Greenland. So I'd rather have somebody focused on, for example, giving universal health care to people in this country. And that's where my policy proposals come in, because I think the public option that I've proposed that would finish the job we started with the Affordable Care Act feels to me like a way to get to universal health care much more quickly than, for example, Bernie's plan, which I respect his ideological commitment to the plan. But I don't think it's where most people in America are. I don't think banning private insurance and putting a $23 trillion tax on the American people is going to be something that people are going to want to sustain as the price for getting universal health care coverage, which we desperately need.
Senator Bennett, before we relinquish you to go back out in the hustings, a question from one of our listeners, which I think is reflected from a bunch of folks. Matt Massey Phelps writes on Twitter, I currently support Senator Bennett for president. His polling has remained relatively low, and his social media following is small versus other candidates. How is his campaign going to get his name out there? And I want to add, it's my understanding that so far you've not yet qualified for the next major Democratic primary televised debates.
That's true, and I appreciate very much Matt's support. If people want to help, they can go to michaelbennett.com and register their support. I am putting, you know, one foot in front of the other. I'm the only candidate in this race who's won two national races in a purple state. I think that in the middle of the country, I think that's really important for the next Democratic nominee to be somebody who can win. And it goes back to the conversation we were just having about policies, because it's about winning in unusual places in order to both beat Donald Trump and restore a Democratic majority to the Senate. That's going to require us to win in places like Colorado and Iowa and Maine and Arizona. And I think I can do that. And I'm not as well known as some of the other candidates. And I wasn't well known before I started running. But I do feel like I'm getting a good reception in New Hampshire and in Iowa and South Carolina. And I'm just going to keep doing it. There's a whole campaign that's going on out there that isn't associated with the debates that we're having once a month to give everybody on the stage 5 minutes to try to express the American people stuff that I think is much more important and much more complex than that that forum can provide. And I'm just going to keep going and try to outwork everybody. And I think in the end, the fact that I'm well aligned with where the base of the Democratic Party is and then can also reach out to independents, I think will be a strength.
That's Democratic U.S. Senator for Colorado and Democratic presidential candidate Michael Bennett. Senator Bennett, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, David. It was great to be with you. Bye.
I want to turn back to our analysts and reporters here, Tolu Olorunipa of The Washington Post, Ginger Gibson of Reuters, our own Jack Beatty. Ginger Gibson, let's talk a little bit about this. He said this is where the base is, that is the center left, pragmatic, more moderate people who win in purple states. I think there's a really interesting dynamic being played out where you've got sort of the folks who think like he does, like, for example, former President Joe Biden does. And then you've got folks like Sanders and Warren and some of the others on the Democratic side of things that are more to the left who are saying, no, people are hungry for something specific to believe in. We need to be able to draw in populists who are perhaps, you know, disaffected working class whites who may want government to do more for them. Actually, this is time for a more progressive, more liberal stance. How is that playing out in the hustings, Ginger?
I mean, this is really the core of the debate in the Democratic primary. It's really a discussion about whether they are a party that still has some moderate pieces or they just want to run full throttle into a very progressive agenda and run a very progressive campaign. I will tell you that when I go out and I talk to voters in places like Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina, I'm always struck by how much I think the Washington sort of bubble thinks that the electorate looks like Twitter, and it doesn't. People really do want a calm. They really do want sort of a return to a bit of I hear often from people that they want to not watch the news anymore, that they want to not feel like they have to know what's happening every day. But at the same time, they want change. They want these policies. They support some of the ideas that they're hearing, and they think, well, if we can get both, that would be great. But I don't know that any of them feel like they found someone that can get them both at this point and really just are adhering to this, we must win. I hear that so often from Democrats when I'm out talking to them, is that they just feel winning must be priority number one.
Tolu, at the White House, obviously the president disparages people in both wings of the Democratic Party, right? He makes up nicknames for Joe Biden and for Warren and for probably half of the rest of the pack as well if they come across his radar. At the same time, in terms of his strategists, what kind of candidate is the White House more fearful of?
Well, if you talk to people in the Trump campaign, they say they want to paint the entire field of Democrats as far left. Socialist is a word that they like to use. So a lot of times they will tell you, at least on the record, that they see all of the candidates as being pulled far to the left. Privately, you do hear some concern about candidates who can perform well in the Midwestern states. They know that this race is likely to come down to Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. And they do see a threat from certain candidates, including Joe Biden, who does have a history there. They have tried to seize on some of the mistakes that he's made, some of the gaffes he's made, and push the message that he's past his prime. We've seen the president pushing that, saying he's lost his fastball, he's not playing with a full deck of cards, and that kind of language. But there is some concern that he has remained steady in most of the polls, and he does have some of that bipartisan support from moderates and people who may have voted for Trump in 2016 but may be disaffected at this point. So there is some concern about Biden. They do see some of the energy right now behind Senator Warren as well. They see she is rising in the polls. She is trying to create a movement. She is starting to get bigger crowds. So they also see her as a potential threat, even though the president believes that he could take her on very easily. He's taken her on over the whole Native American issue. But it's clear that they realize at the Trump campaign that this is going to be a tough fight. Even with a strong economy, there is a lot of motivation among Democrats, among the base, to oust President Trump from office. And everyone that I've talked to that is close to the Trump campaign believes that this is going to be an extraordinarily high turnout election. And that could make it hard for the president, especially if minorities and young people and people who stayed at home in 2016 turn out in 2020.
Ginger, very briefly, do you get any sense that the Warren campaign is still concerned about the Native American issue, the question of her claim of heritage that was borne out sort of by genetic testing but done in a way that seemed to offend some of the tribes who spoke out and said that's not the way you actually determine membership, the president making fun of her, calling her Pocahontas in an offensive way. But does it seem like that stuck? I don't sense that, at least in her public facing, that she really is that concerned about it.
No, you know, Trump talks about how he maybe made a mistake and pulled that attack line out too soon. But Warren's campaign does not seem concerned. In fact, Friday morning, they put out a policy addressing Native Americans and tribal issues directly. Her love of policy positions, this is her newest that came out Friday morning. And you get a sense from her campaign and from her that they know Trump is going to attack her. In fact, all Democrats say this. They know Trump is going to attack them. They know he's going to call them names. They think the kind of voters at this point who would be persuaded by hearing the president call her Pocahontas are probably voters that weren't going to vote for her anyway. And so he's going to call them names and they're going to keep pushing forward. And I think that at this point, they seem pretty undeterred by the pushback or by the president's efforts to keep going to that name calling.
Chuck Beatty, I want to turn now to the question of, because I think it's important that we keep monitoring it here at On Point, the question of guns and addressing how they're handled in the wake of all these series of violent outbursts, these mass shootings. President Trump addressed the recent mass shootings in speaking at a rally in New Hampshire yesterday. In his rhetoric, he shifted emphasis away from such things as background checks and other things he had indicated he might be sympathetic to the question of mental health care.
There is a mental illness problem that has to be dealt with. It's not the gun that pulls the trigger. It's the person holding the gun.
Jack Beatty, the president has, after a number of these mass shootings during his time in office, indicated sympathy with those at times at odds with other Republicans on Capitol Hill, in sympathy with those who would push for greater gun controls. What do you make of his most recent comments, and where does the administration actually stand, all the rhetoric aside?
Well, it sounds like he's in full-scale retreat from those professions of concern about guns and the, you know, saying aloud, well, maybe we can have some progress on this. I thought, frankly, when the mayor of Dayton flattered him very, very tactically, very shrewdly, she said, "You're a man of action, Mr. President, right? You can get this done in a way that Obama couldn't." I thought, man, that'll work. That'll go right to the ego. But apparently the NRA has got to the ego, too. And Mitch McConnell, as we spoke last week, I'm sure they'll talk about it. There'll probably be some kind of vote. Let's hope something will come out of it, if only red flag laws or pressure to enact them at the state level. But Mr. Trump's own commitment to this is wavering at best. You know, Amy Klobuchar had a video she put out a week ago showing a meeting he held, I think, last year with members of Congress, in which 9 times in one meeting he came out for various forms of gun control. 9 times! Mm-hmm. The next day he had lunch with the NRA. All that was forgotten. He is in their pocket.
And Jack, very briefly, is there clarity on the Democratic side that they could coalesce around some things relatively quickly if they got some partnership across the aisle?
Well, I mean, the president said last night the Democrats will, you know, scupper any agreement by putting a poison pill in it, and it'll all, you know, they'll ask too much. I think, I mean, to judge by people like Chris Murphy, from the senator from Connecticut, the Democrats would settle for anything as a beginning, as a token to show that democracy can work. When 90% of the public wants something, the public can get at least something.
We've been talking about the news this week with our Reporters Roundtable this week featuring Ginger Gibson, political correspondent for Reuters. Thanks so much, Ginger, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Tolu Olorunipa, White House reporter for The Washington Post. Great to have you with us again as well.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And, of course, we say goodbye to our On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty. Have a great weekend, Jack.
Thank you, David.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Me, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.